Pushing Mudsloth to its navigational limits, Luke began to contrive a spiraling approach that would keep the mass of Jatipatan between the skiff and the Yevathan vessel. "Best for everyone if they never see us at all," he said as he charted the course. Akana looked on from behind his flight couch.
"Done."
Luke looked up at her quizzically.
It can't be that easy."
"Why not?"
"Well, don't you have to know who it is you're trying to hide from?"
"Why?"
"So you have a focus, so you know whose thoughts you're trying to deflect."
She raised her eyebrows.
"That's coercive and invasive. You reach into another mind and bind its thoughts or place your own there."
"Well, yes. But the purpose must be important enough to justify the deed and the consequences."
"It seems the Jedi are always finding reasons to justify their violence. I wish you would try as hard to find ways to avoid it. Besides, it's inefficient. It requires your constant attention. The ultimate goal is to make that which must be hidden not merely resemble its surroundings, but merge with them."
Akana closed her eyes and drew a deep breath. She let the breath out slowly as she lowered her head.
And then she was not there.
"I'll be a..."
Luke reached for her where she had been standing, but grabbed only air.
"Cute trick. Handy for breaking into libraries, escaping arranged marriages. Where are you?"
"Here."
Her voice came from behind him. He turned to find her sitting down, wearing a proud smile.
"Did I touch your mind?"
"No,"
he admitted.
Not that I could notice."
Akana nodded.
"A long time ago, one of the Circle discovered that when she achieved a particularly profound meditation of immersion, she would disappear from the view of others. Much later, we learned how to take an object into the meditation with us and leave it there."
"And you've merged this ship?"
"Yes, while I was in meditation."
"So we're completely undetectable now?"
"No, nothing is absolute, but we are safe from eyes and from the machines that are like eyes. Take us directly to Jatipatan, Luke, as quickly as you can. I promise you that we won't be discovered, not by the beings in that starship."
The stone ruins of the Temple of Jatipatan sprawled over more than 2,000 hectares. The ruins filled the floor of a pocket valley with an intricate pattern and climbed the inner walls of the enclosing hills. But it was clear long before Mudsloth landed in the middle of an open diamond that the ambitions of the Hikig, the colonists mentioned on the fleet office data cards, had collided with the ambitions of the Yevatha, and the latter had triumphed. Luke climbed down from the skiff and began to walk. There was a sick smell on the breeze, and his eyes began to pick out the blackened lumps of corpses among the scattered stones. He turned back toward the skiff, looking for Akana. She was climbing over a jumble of stones that had once been a wall, and then breaking into a run. Puzzled, he called after her. "Akana? What is it? Where are you going?" When she did not even look back, he started after her, but then she vanished, as thoroughly as she had aboard the ship. Luke sat down on the edge of a giant building stone that was scorched and cracked in half.
"No Yevatha. No Falanasi. No Akana," he said aloud.
"No Imperial troopers. No Nashira. So why am I here? What's this all been about?"
"There's something here, still not seen."
Prodded by his own words, Luke turned his head to one side, then the other. "Maybe a lot of somethings not seen," he said more loudly. When there was no response, he stood and called.
"At first, I thought you were hiding from whoever did this, Akana. But they're long gone, aren't they? And you didn't run away in fear, no. You wouldn't need to. Which leaves only one conclusion. You were running toward something. That you found what you were looking for. That the Circle is here."
10 meters away, 3 women suddenly appeared, as though they had stepped through an invisible curtain. One wore a white gown with diagonal sky-blue bands. Her silver hair tumbled down her shoulders to her waist.
A second, copper-skinned and short-haired, wore a dusty yellow wrap that started low on her hips and fell to her knees. Akana was standing between them, clinging to their hands with fierce possessiveness, her face streaked with tears of joy.
This is Rialu, who marked the way for me. And this is Nori, Norika, my friend of long ago.
She looked from one to the other with an almost disbelieving expression in her eyes. Then she looked toward Luke.
Yes, Luke, I am finally home.
Rialu released Akana's hand and came forward to where a stunned Luke stood.
You helped our child Akana return to us. We are grateful to you for that. Akana tells us the burden was taken freely, but the risk and sacrifice were substantial. Is there a debt owed?
What? Luke searched Akana's face. Not a debt, no. Rialu nodded.
You are the man of honor that she said you were. Your friendship to the Valenasi will be remembered. But now your ship's presence on this planet is a danger.
It's Akana's ship.
She has given it to you in gratitude, but it is also simple pragmatism that she do so.
Luke squinted. Are you telling me I have to leave?
I am grateful for your understanding.
Luke looked again to Akana, expecting her to speak out. I can't do that. Akana isn't the only one who came here hoping for a reunion. I'm searching for someone, too. Her name is Nashira. Rialu's expression did not change, but she inclined her head almost imperceptibly, as though listening to something Luke could not hear.
I am sorry. I do not say I know the name. I do not say that I do not know the name. I cannot help you.
I can't accept that. If she's here, you have to at least tell her that I'm here. I'm her son.
I'm sorry. My answer must be the same. I cannot help an outsider.
Akana let go of Norika's hand and turned to Rialu.
He's not an outsider. He asked to learn the ways of the current, and I have taken him as my student. This is impossible, said Rialu, for you are but an untrained child yourself.
Akana's eyes flashed anger.
You do not understand the importance of his presence. You do not understand the importance of his quest. Do not do this, Akana.
Rialu spoke with sadness rather than threat.
What choice have you left me?
Closing her eyes, Akana threw her head back and drew a sharp breath. The air trembled. The bodies, the ruins, began to shimmer. Then everything was transformed. The burned bodies vanished. The shattered stones healed. The scarred hills smoothed. The tragedy of the ruins was transformed into a glorious work in progress, filling the valley in every direction, and undertaken by thousands of solemnly industrious Hikik. Akana gazed defiantly at Rialu, whose answering look mixed gentle reproof and regret. My stars, Luke breathed. It wasn't destroyed? You've been hiding this from the Yavetha?
Yes.
Rialu looked around.
The temple embodies the Hikik vision of the universe, the eternal, the conscious. It is the life's work of a community united by the purpose that defines them.
Is this why you're here?
Yes. And it is why you must leave.
You're protecting them, protecting this.
She nodded. Please, your ship is resting in what will be the inner court of the Transcendent. It is distracting the Hikig and disrupting the work.
Wait, Luke said. The day of the attack, what happened here?
We protected ourselves and these people and the others where we could. I will not say more.
Luke began to understand. Protected them with illusions. Rialu, what you were able to prevent from happening here happened on a dozen other planets where there was no Falanasi circle to provide a shield and deceive the Yavetha. The bodies on those worlds were real.
We know what happened there, said Rialu.
A harder edge crept into Luke's voice. Then let me ask you what you know about what's about to happen. What the Yveatha did has been challenged by my sister Leia, the president of the New Republic. Two opposing fleets are gathering up there, hundreds of ships, tens of thousands of soldiers. If this war comes, it will be long, brutal, and bloody, and it will come here. He saw that his words had reached her fears.
I have seen it coming.
Will you help me try to stop it?
We cannot allow ourselves to be used that way. It is not our war. It is yours and theirs.
He gestured around them. Neither was this your war, but you intervened and saved these lives and this treasure. He pointed at Akana. She challenged me to put down my weapon and try to find other ways to serve my conscience. What she asked isn't easy for me. But I've seen the worth in trying. Now I challenge you to give up your isolation and be the water that quenches the flame.
Norica asked, What can we do?
You can deceive them, as you have here, but on a grander scale.
Mualu raised an eyebrow questioningly.
You believe that if the Yveatha face overwhelming odds, they may yield?
I have to think that their lives mean something to them. More, I hope, than their claim to Chitipitan does. Whether they surrender or just withdraw, many lives on both sides would be saved.
Wialu appeared to be considering his proposal.
It would be necessary for the fleet commander to be part of this plan.
I can find the fleet. I can take you to General Abbott.
Then I will go with you. And we will see how great a fire is burning.
The outer gardens of Mon Mothma's house in Cirtsi were vivid patches of purple, cobalt blue, and pale orange. The air in the tree moat was cool and fragrant. Leia was enveloped by the deep peacefulness of the old forest. She had not seen Mon Mothma for several months, but there had always been times like this one, when she knew that the former head of the New Republic was the only person who could truly understand what she was going through. Mon Mothma rested her hand gently on Leia's.
How are the children, Kepi?
Jaina is angry. Jason is afraid, Leia said. Anakin is mostly confused. He can't understand why anyone would want to hurt his daddy. We've managed to keep them from seeing the recording, but I had to tell them. Too many other people know.
Mon Mothma squeezed Leia's hand.
And you? How are you doing?
I'm having trouble seeing my way.
Mon Mothma nodded. What do you want, Leia?
Han, home, safe. The Yveatha held to account. And I want to keep this job, because there's still work to do.
And if you cannot have them all, which of those would you surrender last? Leia stood and looked out over the garden.
I know how I must answer that question. The moment we begin to think about staying in power, before we think of anything else, we betray the rebellion. That's the heart of what we were rebelling against.
Mon Mothma nodded.
It was, at the end, the only idea Palpatine stood for.
Leia turned and looked back at her mentor.
But I still don't know how to choose between the other two.
I think you do.
What you don't know is how to live with the choice. And there, I can be of no help to you. That secret escaped you when the clarity left you.
Leia returned to sit on the edge of the stool at Mon Mothma's feet.
When did that happen? I didn't see it go, did you?
Your clarity
came from your certainty that our cause was just and our purpose worthy. But there is little certainty to be had in a place like the Senate, in a city like Imperial City. Certainty is eaten away by the 1,001 compromises that are the currency of democracy.
Mon Mothma's eyes were sympathetic.
You have always drawn your map with straight lines,
Leia. And in that respect, you were ill-prepared for the arcane cartography of the Senate.
She smiled.
There is something your father told me a long time ago when I was new to Coruscant and its ways were a mystery. He said, Do not expect to be applauded when you do the right thing. And do not expect to be forgiven when you err. But even your enemies
will respect commitment.
Leia's eyes had misted.
That sounds like Bail, all right.
Mon Mothma gathered the younger woman into a fond embrace.
Draw a straight line,
Leia.
You will see where it leads.
There was still an hour to go before the New Republic Assembly would convene to consider the petition of recall against Leia. But seats at both the media and the public levels were already filled, and the corridors outside were choked. There was a collective gasp when Ben Kilnam and Leia entered together and ascended to the upper tier of the podium. Ben Kilnam began to speak.
Fellow senators, there will be a change in the published schedule for today's session. I yield the gavel to the President of the Senate, Leia Organa Solo, hereditary princess of House Organa of Alderaan, and elected senator of the restored Republic of Alderaan.
As Leia came forward, something unexpected happened. In scattered twos and threes, then pockets of 10 and 20, senators rose to their feet, applauding. Leia raised her hand for silence.
Please, I'm grateful for your support. I accept it as a deeply felt expression of your concern for Han, mirroring the concern which so many people from all over the New Republic have shared with our family. But I did not come here today to speak of Han, or to presume on your sympathy. I have come here to make an announcement in a matter of great gravity. At 1330 today, in the presence of the Chairman of the Defense Council, the First Administrator, the Minister of State, the Admiral of the Fleet, and the Director of the Intelligence Ministry, I invoked the emergency powers provisions of Article 5 with respect to the crisis in Farlak Sector. A startled gasp from thousands of throats tore the silence. That is the formal language required by the Charter. It can be said more simply. We have declared war on the Duskan League. This is not a personal crusade or a political maneuver. It is a campaign for justice. Justice for the victims and justice for the criminals. The crimes of the Yavetha are not as well known to you as they should be or as they will be. You have seen the faces of two of Nilspar's victims, Han and Plat Malar. But what the Yavetha have done to these two, as much as it hurts those who love them, is among the least of their offenses. The Duskan League is led by an absolute dictator who has exterminated, without the slightest provocation, the populations of more than a dozen peaceful worlds. If these horrors do not demand our answer, then shame on us. If these tragedies do not enrage your conscience, then shame on you. If we cannot stand up together against such a predator, the New Republic stands for nothing of value. Any government which objects to this decision is free to withdraw from this body. And this body is welcome to choose a new president. The day after Nilspar is defeated and the Yavetha disarmed. Leia turned to descend from the platform. She had not gone two steps before a roar of approval washed up over her from the floor below and the galleries above. The acclaim was not unanimous. Dozens of dissenting senators had remained in their seats or headed for the exits in outrage, but they were a startlingly tiny minority. Leia would have been moved to joy, but for the fact that at the end of the straight line she had drawn, she saw Han's death. When Colonel Bakbakat and his team arrived at the icy world of Motha Obex, they were greeted by Johto Eccles, the head of the archaeological team. They met aboard the archaeological vessel Penga Rift. As soon as Bakbakat informed the archaeologist about the vagabond and his plan to summon it home, Eccles was eager to provide information about the Kella, if in a somewhat distracted fashion. The major distraction was the dispatch containing the report on the Kella genome.
Oh, these bodies examined by Dr. Eycross. What an extraordinary discovery, he said. This report is based on the single example I delivered to Huck and Dyson, yes?
That private collector you told me about. I assume so, said Pakpakat.
It appears to be the only Keller material to have left the system.
We do not know if these Eichroff bodies are typical of the species.
Presumably not.
Eccles closed his datapad.
Colonel, we have 5 additional Keller bodies in the specimen lab. If I could take this data back to the lab for a few hours, I may be able to answer that question, and perhaps some others as well.
It wasn't long before Eccles' skiff came up again alongside Lady Luck, and he boarded, fairly bursting with excitement.
It seems the Keller have an extraordinary set of extended proteins in their bodies. Their genetic instructions enable them to build structures that seem to exist on the dividing line between living and non-living.
Are you certain? Asked Pakpakat. Why didn't the people who discovered them know any of this?
Because I have something available to me that they didn't. They didn't have samples of the finished product to compare with those genetic instructions. I have 600 of them.
600, repeated Bijo Hammocks. 600 bodies?
Artifacts.
Eccles raised an eyebrow.
600 Keller artifacts. Oh, no. We will need a new word for them now. We recorded them as being fashioned from natural materials. Now I know they were not fashioned, but grown. The Eichroff bodies contain their plans. Do you understand what I'm saying, Colonel?
Yes, said Pakpakat.
No,
said Hammocks. Eccles turned toward the soldier.
Every sentient being inherits its species' memories through both body and mind. The ancient duality. Humans found a way to extend our memories by recording our thoughts and collecting them in libraries. Somehow, a long time ago, the Keller found another way. They carried their libraries within their own bodies.
Pakpakat's understanding grew.
The capsules the bodies contain are the instructions for building a starship from that which is more than inanimate and less than alive. The ship we are chasing was not designed or invented. It was remembered.
Yes,
Eccles said. Do you think that somewhere in those sequences is a code which will call the vagabond back? Asked Tysden. Eccles smiled.
Well, since it has not gone somewhere else in all this time, I suspect that it was intended to come back here.
The exceptionally sensitive sensor dish atop the Millennium Falcon had no difficulty picking out Pride of Yveatha from among the many ships orbiting Nazoth. While Chewbacca had been with his son in the forest, Jodrell had made several modifications on the Millennium Falcon. The starboard pod had been replaced by a mine launcher loaded with 16 firecracker mines. The portside pod had been replaced by a hull-cutting rig. Chewbacca heard the comm board chirp, signifying an incoming message. To Chewbacca's surprise, it was for Meiji. The broker greeted him cheerfully.
Chewbacca, hot-blooded friend. Mining archives, I found something else maybe you can use. No charge. Tell Solo I will get it back from him at Sabak.
By the time the attached data had been downloaded, Lumpawarump had joined his father in the cockpit. What are you looking at? He asked eagerly. Chewbacca answered, A friend sent something interesting. What they saw was a fleet intelligence assault plan for a superstar destroyer. A complete three-dimensional technical drawing of the ship, with the location of the cell blocks marked, the best broaching sites highlighted, and the shortest paths between them drawn in. Chewbacca ordered everyone on board to study the map. Chewbacca realized that the assault plan could not have come from Formeji's archive. The time stamp on the document was less than 2 days old. When Millennium Falcon burst out of hyperspace 1,100 meters off the starboard bow of Pride of Yveatha, the intense burst of light and radiation from the first of the firecracker mines flooded the sensors of the Yveathan defense grid, momentarily blinding the operators and scrambling the analyzers.
The mines continue to explode at 10-second intervals, effectively masking the Cronau radiation from both ends of Falcon's microjump. Meanwhile, Chewbacca whipped the transport into a smart half-turn, standing it on its tail, the engines at maximum thrust. For the gun crews aboard the Yavathan flagship, it was like looking up into the subatomic fury of a fusion reactor. For seconds afterwards, the best-positioned batteries could not see to find their target. By the time the first blaster bolts lanced out from the side of Pride of Yavatha and from the two trifoil fighters closing in, the Falcon was inside the shield radius and Chewbacca had spotted his landing site. Chewie's cousin Shoran hurried to the port pod hatch where the hull-cutting mechanism was attached as Chewbacca gently nestled the Falcon against the enemy vessel's hull, allowing the cutting ring's magna grapples to grab hold. By the time Chewbacca joined Shoran, the cutting ring had already burned halfway through the armored plastion. The Pawaru was there as well, holding both Chewbacca's weapons and his own, ready to take up his assigned task of defending the entrance to the Falcon. Jaudrill shouted down the access tunnel, "Chewbacca, they've stopped firing on us all of a sudden. I can see half a dozen fighters flying past, but they're ignoring us." "Hold your fire," Chewbacca replied. "It just means they expect to handle us from the inside." Chewbacca collected his blaster rifle from Numpawarum, then placed a paw on his son's shoulder. "Go, trade places with Jaudrill," he said. "Hurry!" Finally, the metal disc cut from Pride of Yuvetha's hull blew back into the enemy ship as a spectacular half-ton projectile. Chewbacca and Shoran poured through the opening, wielding heavy blasters in each hand. Standing back to back, they quickly cut down the half-dozen Yuvetha who came running at the sound of the breach. They began to make their way through the ship, staying in frequent contact with Jaudrill. She reported that, strangely, the Falcon continued to remain undisturbed, even though 9 armed Yavatha had walked right past the cut hatch as if it were invisible. Chewie and Shoran, searching the detention blocks for Han, were not so lucky. Their noisy entrance into detention block 2 had drawn a small crowd of Yavathan soldiers, roaring defiance. Chewbacca sprayed the corridor with crisscrossing blaster bolts. The last of his targets was tottering when he heard Shoran grunt and felt him sag against his back. A whiff of burnt hair and fresh blood reached Chewbacca's nostrils. Whirling, Chewbacca caught Shoran up with one hand before he could fall and dispatched the last 2 Yavatha with a flurry of shots from the blaster in the other hand. He shouted into his comlink, "Shoran has fallen. Dianta, come for him." Lupawarum was the first to the cut hatch, leading Dianta by 3 steps. "I'm going with you," he said. "I know the map." They met Chewbacca halfway to detention block 2. Dianta took Shoran from him without a word and hurried back toward the Falcon, leaving Lumpawarum with his father. Detention block 1 was being guarded by half a dozen armed Yavatha, which raised Chewbacca's hopes that this was where Han might be held. But when he and his son had blasted their way through the guards, all they found were grossly distended fleshy sacks hanging in the cells. "What are these repulsive things?" Chewbacca fumed. "Where is Han?" Lupawarum spoke hesitantly. "Father, when I think about Han, I get a picture in my mind. It's as if somebody was putting it there. And I don't see him in a place like this." Chewbacca hushed him with a wave of his paw. "Be quiet, I have to think." But Lumpawarum, with a strange new courage, persisted. "I keep seeing him in a room full of people. A large room. And all different species. I don't know why." And then Chewbacca realized that the picture was in his own mind as well. He focused. "In your mind, is there a number?" Lumpawarum squeezed his eyes closed. D2. It was the same as what Chewbacca saw. Bold black lettering high on the bulkhead above the prisoners. "Cargo D2. The mass detention holds. Come." The doors of the hold were guarded by 6 Yavatha deployed behind a pair of Imperial portable shields. Chewbacca and Lumpawarum crouched in the hatchway. Chewbacca turned to his son. "Your bowcaster," he said. Lumpawarum unslung the weapon and began to surrender it to his father, but found to his surprise
that there was no hand extended to take it from him.
Chewbacca gestured with his blaster. "Go for the ones on the extreme left and right first," he shouted. "Fire as quickly as you can." Chewbacca looked back at Lumpawarum. "This is your Hurtiak," he said.
"I'm ready, Father."
With his father's hunger for vengeance driving his legs, Lumpawarum crossed the open deck with stunning speed. None of the blaster bolts directed his way came anywhere near him. By the time he reached the guard station, every one of the guards had fallen victim to his steady hand and hunter's eye. One Yevathan guard still stood. He slashed the air with his claws. Chewbacca roared a challenge. Their short struggle ended with Chewbacca hurling his huge attacker against a column. Standing over the body, Chewbacca tipped back his head and made the Wookiee triumph cry echo to the farthest corners of the flight deck. Then he waved Lumpawarum over to join him. Only then did Chewbacca see that his son was dragging his right leg as he ran. Lumpawarum had not uttered a sound in complaint. He had faced his foe, his Katarn, without flinching. And his aim had been true. The woman called Inara crouched beside Han, who lay dozing, and she lightly touched an unbruised spot on his forearm.
"There is fighting on the ship. Your friends have come for you."
Moving awakened a thousand pains and brought a wince to Han's face, but he struggled to a sitting position.
"For me? How do you know?"
"I know. Come, we must move you. It is not safe to be close to the walls."
Han allowed Inara to help him limp to the center of the hold. There she sat down beside him, arranging the folds of her scorched brown caftan around her, as though it were a fine gown and she was expecting guests.
"They are a long way from here. I cannot hide them. It is too much for me, but I will try to help them find you."
Han did not question her. She was a puzzling woman, given to curious pronouncements and long periods of distraction, marked by a faraway gaze and an aversion to company. But of all the prisoners in the hold, she was the only one to step beyond her own fears to befriend him. After a while, he saw that her face was pale, and he felt her hands trembling.
"Inara, what's wrong?" I cannot keep them apart. So many dying."
Han struggled to a seated position just as Inara pitched forward, whimpering, her palms pressed to her forehead, her tousled hair hiding her face. Moments later, there were noises from beyond the door. Then the door was flung open, and a towering Wookiee frame filled the opening. "Chewie!" Chewbacca rushed across the deck and scooped Han up into his arms. Slinging him over one shoulder, Chewbacca started back toward the hatch.
"Wait! Wait! Chewbacca, the others! We have to take them, too!"
As Chewbacca reluctantly complied, Han saw that Inara was still seated where she had been, though no longer doubled over.
"Inara! Come on, there's room for you, too! Chewie, how many of them can we get?"
His words trailed off as he looked around the hold. None of the other prisoners had reacted at all to what was happening. They were scattered in their usual haunts and gatherings, sleeping, talking, sucking water from the drip pipes. He took two unsteady steps toward Inara.
"What's happening? Come on, our reservation here is expired."
"I cannot go. Go, please. I am at my limit."
"I don't understand."
Inara shook her head sharply. When she did, the rest of the prisoners vanished.
"No, you are inside, seeing as I do."
"Where are the others?"
"They were never here. They escaped at the transfer camp and were picked up by Star Morning. They are safe. You can go."
Han stared at her in disbelief.
"You were covering their escape?" "Never mind, it doesn't matter. You can leave now, too,"
she answered softly.
"I must stay. Denied his prizes, Nilsfar would seek security through the death of his enemies. Go, Han. I am not a prisoner here. I have chosen this freely."
Turning away from them, Inara lowered her chin to her collarbone. An instant later, the hostages reappeared, including a crippled, dozing Han Solo, lying on the deck beside Inara. At just about the same time that Millennium Falcon was roaring away from Pride of Yveta behind a curtain of exploding firecracker mines, Mudsloth was dropping out of hyperspace in front of the Fifth Fleet's flagship. The gunship Warrior placed itself on an intercept course.
Contact ahead, the tactical officer announced to the bridge.
On the other side of the room, a blank display at COM 3
suddenly lit up with a string of numbers.
The numbers vanished from the display to be replaced by Luke Skywalker's face.
Captain, do you recognize me?
The Warrior's captain frowned.
I recognize who you appear to be. I have no information that that person was in this sector.
Very good, Captain. Once you've satisfied yourself that I am who I appear to be, I trust you can arrange for a ride or an escort to the flagship. I am carrying some extremely important information for the fleet commander.
Luke had asked for a private meeting with Abbott, Wialu, and Akana aboard the Intrepid, but that had perhaps been too much to expect. Abbott's idea of private included two spare colonels and an extra captain. Luke dealt with it by ignoring them and getting right to the point.
General Abbott,
what's the status of the conflict?
The President has declared war on the Yveta,
said Abbott.
As a first step, we're preparing to reclaim Dornick 319. We've also gotten more aggressive in searching for the remaining shipyards. Planning's underway for deeper penetrations of the cluster, all the way to the Yvathan homeworlds.
Luke leaned forward, knowing this would not be easy.
I've come here from Jitipatan.
I'm here to offer you an alternate route to victory. Even for someone with Luke's status, Colonel Corgan, Colonel Mawita, and Captain Morano were a tough audience, especially when what was being peddled had the look of magic.
I am not eager to risk the lives of my crew on tricks, said Morano.
Luke answered with studied patience.
What Wialu is offering us is no trick. Her methods are older than the technology of that blaster you wear, and more powerful.
Abbott asked,
would it be possible to have a demonstration?
Luke expected Wialu to refuse, but she surprised him.
As the skeptics watched from the observation bubble of a maintenance rover, Wialu made 22 ships coming in from the Fourth Fleet to join the rest of the forces look like more than 40. One after another, the great ships emerged out of the center of overlapping white flashes of radiation, like new stars winking on in the night. Cruisers and attack carriers, star destroyers and gunships all quickly closed the distance to the rover, roaring by overhead.
Abbott turned to the other officers.
Well, gentlemen, we have our demonstration.
The rover was on final approach to Intrepid when they were waved off for the launch of a flight of fighters. Morano looked worried.
What's that about? Patrol rotation isn't for another hour.
He got an answer from the flight controller after the rover landed.
Outer patrol is moving out on an intercept. We've got a ship coming in from the interior. High speed, no proper ID, nothing but some kind of jammer in response to our hail.
Luke raced to the bridge at General Abbott's heels, then anchored himself in front of a tracking display.
Can you let me hear that jammer signal she was transmitting?
On the headphones, sir. Watch the volume. It's an eardrum killer.
Luke slipped the earpieces in place and listened. Almost at once, he laughed.
Ha! That's not a jammer! That's Wookiee talk!
Better tell those fighters they're on a rendezvous and escort, not an intercept.
That's the Millennium Falcon coming in.
Technically, the camp on Pyal, the primary moon of the fifth planet of the Nizoth system, was not a prison. Slaves are not housed in prisons. The camp was the permanent residence of the surviving Imperials of the Black Sword Command occupation force. At its peak, it had housed nearly 300,000. Mostly human and mostly from the crews of the Star Destroyers Intimidator and Valorous. The ships were captured by Yvathan raiders on what was to have been the final day of the Imperial occupation. The captives had purchased their lives with service to the Viceroy, and had taught the Yvatha both the operation of capital warships and the secrets of their construction. They had served aboard their renamed vessels under new alien captains,
and labored in the shipyards under new alien overseers. When the crew members ceased to be useful to their captors, they were killed. Many committed suicide. Conditions on Pa'al were miserable, and hope of rescue had collapsed as the coldly calculated winnowing wore on. Those who survived to see the fourth year were, in many ways, a select group. Smart, tough-minded, inured to the privations of their existence. Now, with the increased activity in the camp and the prisoners' growing awareness of the coming war, they had found a replacement for hope, in the form of a leader and a plan.
There is a moment coming,
Major Syl Saranen had told his secret command.
A moment of opportunity that will never be repeated in our lifetimes. If we are not ready when that moment comes, we will all die on Pa'al.
While Han was treated in the medical ward, the New Republic command staff analyzed the latest data from the stasis probes deep inside the cluster, and the Wookiees, minus Shoran, whose wound had been fatal, prepared the Falcon for the battle ahead. Not included in any of those activities, Luke found himself alone and with time on his hands. He went by Wayalu and Akana's cabin, intending to reopen the subject of Nashira, but Wayalu was not there, and Akana would not tell him where he could find her, saying only, "She will be in deep meditation until the time comes." Although it was clear that Akana was distracted, Luke sat down.
Did you know that there's a Falanasi aboard Pride of Yuvetha? At least that's how I sort it out, going by Chewbacca's account. A woman named Inara.
He shook his head.
They had to have some kind of help. Going in there like that was crazy, Wookiee crazy. The kind that comes from an excess of courage and a shortage of patience.
Yes, I know, Akana said.
Will she be able to help Wialu?
I do not think so.
Luke frowned. You seem to have gotten a lot more reluctant to talk to me since we reached Tipitan.
Akana gave a small, rueful smile. Circumstances have changed.
Because Wialu is watching and listening?
We have lost more than privacy. We are no longer moving in the same direction.
Well, if you know that, you know more than I do. You could answer some of my questions as my teacher.
Eyes downcast, Akana shook her head. I don't think so, Luke.
Because of what Wialu said about your not having the right to? She said you were a child yourself.
What she said was true. The loss of what my mother would have taught me has left me less than whole.
Your mother, Talsava, is she with the Circle?
No. Now, please, ask me no more.
All right. Luke stood. But when he reached the cabin door, he stopped and looked back. I'm sorry, I have to ask one more question.
She nodded as though she had expected it.
Did you see Nashira on Jitipatan?
Akana answered with regret. No. I do not know where she is.
It was decided early that the Phantom Fleet bluff should be played where it would have the most impact, in the light of N'Zoth's sun, over the capital of the Duskan League and the home of Viceroy Nilspar. Colonel Corgan described the plan for Operation Stronghand.
Oh, if planned a feint at Dornach 319 for the day before, just to keep them jumpy and maybe draw off a ship or two from somewhere else. And on the big day, we'll turn out in strength at Wazika, Tizon, and Zafel. Plus, go after the shipyard that we've located near Tholas. But the big play is at N'Zoth. That's where we have to break them one way or another.
The feint at Dornach 319 went off without a hitch, and the fleet shot down a Yvethan thrust ship into the bargain. The final tactical conference for Stronghand included not only the commanders of all 16 battle groups by Hypercom Hololink, but also Luke, Wialu, and Abbott's 5 senior aides. Abbott announced the bad news.
The last survey of the N'Zoth and Zvil systems show that the Yvethan fleets there continue to be reinforced by ships coming in from elsewhere in Cornach Cluster. That means, if they call our bluff, we end up in a tussle.
He looked down the table at Wialu.
Lots riding on you, madam.
As the hollows began dissolving one after another, Abbott leaned toward Luke.
Can I talk to you in my office for a moment? If this comes to a shooting war, I'd like to have the benefit of your experience and leadership,
Abbott told Luke.
I'd like to offer you command of Red E Squadron.
Luke smiled. I'm sorry. I appreciate your confidence, but I have to say no.
Abbott frowned.
I'm not sure I understand. What are your plans, then?
I intend to be with Wialu and Akana on the observation deck. I asked them to involve themselves in our conflict as a matter of principle. Now, I have to show that I respect that same principle myself. I cannot participate in violent acts. I'll celebrate a victory with you no matter how it comes, but my part in it will not be...